This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for August 13th, 2009. I'm Amy Brown here with Meredith DeFrancesco. In recent days, the activist community in this part of Maine has been abuzz with reports that a federal grand jury has been convened in Bangor and may be investigating local activists. We have been able to confirm the existence of a grand jury and some information that indicates that it may be focusing on at least one person who has ties to the activist community. So far, the parties involved have not come forward publicly, and James McCarthy, the U.S. assistant attorney who issued the subpoena, has refused to answer our questions. The federal grand jury process has been used extensively in other parts of the U.S., most notably as part of the Green Scare witch hunt against environmental activists that took place in the western states. Whether local activists are being targeted or not, attorneys who have dealt with this issue say it's important to know your rights should someone knock on your door with a subpoena. This week on Radioactive, we'll be focusing on that issue, and we'll also be taking it up again on Weekend Voices this coming Saturday. Saturday on Weekend Voices, local attorneys Phil Warden and Lynn Williams will be weighing in on the issue, and we start today with some background on how federal grand juries were used to target community activists in the West. We're joined today by Lauren Regan. She's an attorney and the executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center based in Eugene, Oregon. And she was involved with some of the cases that have come to be known as the Green Scare, mostly in the western U.S. And first off, Lauren, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the federal grand jury process was used in those cases of environmental activists being prosecuted in the West.
Sure. The crimes themselves occurred between 1997 and 2001. And somewhere around 2004, 2005, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI began doing what's called knock and talks, where they would show up at people's doors and randomly begin asking them to provide information about their community, about various activists, about different organizations, et cetera, et cetera. And for the most part, you know, many people closed the door and didn't participate in that type of conversation. But some people, out of fear or ignorance, did answer questions. And it was probably that initial information that then launched the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office into issuing hundreds of grand jury subpoenas. In the early stages of this investigation, they really had no clue at all who they were looking for. The crimes themselves did not leave any evidence behind in terms of fingerprints or other types of forensic evidence, so there really were virtually no clues as to who the suspects of the crimes were. And so, especially in Eugene, where I live, there were dozens and dozens of grand jury subpoenas that were issued to just random individuals, you know, clearly illustrating the old adage of an FBI witch hunt. And interestingly, at some point, they began, you know, because of people who cooperated, they began to target a woman by the name of Josephine Overraker, who they believed was an herbalist. Was a woman who practiced herbalism medicine in Eugene. And because of that little hint, they began to subpoena any woman in Eugene that they could find that might have ties to plants and herbalism and whatnot. And this was particularly troubling because, you know, often the government, when issuing these types of subpoenas, they will target who they view are as weaker links. And so they were targeting women in particular, and several of the women had children, which is a usual tactic of the government as well, because those people have extra concerns in terms of whether or not they want to cooperate with the government or not. You know, anyone who receives a grand jury subpoena, especially as an activist, immediately has to come to grips with an extremely difficult decision. Are they going to resist this type of government repression against their movement and their community, or are they going to cooperate with the government? And if they resist or want to resist, that could very likely result in them going to jail, and for up to 6 months in some circumstances. So clearly, women with children, and especially single moms, which were particularly targeted out here, they have this very difficult decision of whether or not to risk going to jail and leaving their children on the outside, which obviously, because that is a regular government tactic against activist communities, it really raises the issue of solidarity and community support when these types of witch hunts occur in their communities. You know, people literally need to step up not only with fundraising, but potentially child care, pet care, getting employment so that the mortgage gets paid and all sorts of things like that. So the Green Scare in general, we estimate that there have probably been over 200 grand jury subpoenas issued to law-abiding, innocent citizens who had no other connection to these crimes other than being part of an activist community or knowing these people personally. Because, of course, you know, out of those 200 people who were harassed in this way, only about a dozen to two dozen people were ever actually charged with crimes. And especially in those early days, out of 100 or so grand jury subpoenas, only about 10 people were actually ultimately rounded up. And those 10 people really were not rounded up as a result of information that the government found through the grand jury process. Those people were rounded up as a result of a single informant who was also a participant in the crimes, who agreed with the FBI to wear a wire and travel around the country and attempt to entrap his fellow activists. So the grand jury process, though often used to harass, to repress, and to silence activist communities, you know, sending that chill out throughout the entire community, are actually tools that are not very effective in terms of law enforcement and actually, you know, bringing criminals to justice. More often than not, the way the FBI gets that type of information is by coercing people into becoming informants.
So I'll ask you in just a moment about what the different options are for people who, and what happens, the consequences are for people who refuse to testify. But let's start with people who, you mentioned, they cast a very wide net, people who think they have absolutely nothing to hide and the questions that they're being asked are innocent questions. What are the dangers in them answering those innocent questions?
Well, there is no such thing as an innocent question when it's given by the FBI or the federal government, particularly when we're talking about activist-based prosecutions, number one. Number two, anyone who normally will willingly provide information to the government becomes a conduit for the government. Sometimes people think, oh, if I just answer these questions, they'll leave me alone. But once you're identified as a weak spot, you know, as a source of information, you can bet that the government is going to frequent you. Once a good source of info, always a good source, and you will be visited a number of times as a particular source. So thinking that by answering a couple of mundane questions, you're taking the pressure off of yourself is normally not a very prudent bit of advice to follow.
What types of questions do they ask? And I know that attorneys, I don't understand why, but I know that part of the process is that your attorney is not allowed to be present in the room with you. They can be outside. You can run out and ask them questions periodically. But what types of questions do they ask? And do they try to trick people into saying things?
Well, yeah. I mean, number one, the government and all law enforcement are legally allowed to lie to you. So often, you know, they will try to baby step you into more and more incriminating information. But the types of questions often are, you know, showing a bunch of pictures of your friends and fellow activists, asking you to identify them and tell the government what you know about them, what activities are they involved with, even ridiculous questions like, so do you think that they would burn down a horse slaughterhouse facility? Have you ever seen them playing with explosives? And then, you know, the other usual round of questions are things like, who else does this person know? Who else do they work with? Who else are in your organizations? Does your organization condone violence? You know, and all sorts of philosophical, political questions are normally part of this process. And, of course, they can ask more specific questions. You know, did you ever ride in a car with this person? Do you remember what you were doing in September of this and that year? And sometimes people think that they can outsmart a U.S. attorney in a grand jury process, but people should remember that perjury is an indictable offense. And if the feds believe you're lying, even if you are not, you know, even if it's the best of your recollection, if the feds later get information from an informant that differs from what you've given, you potentially have opened yourself up to a perjury prosecution, which can also result in jail time. Other questions, you know, relate to trying to find other names and other people that they can subpoena. You know, if you don't know the answer to a question, who might know? And by answering these questions that might seem mundane, you are further empowering the prosecution to go out and harass additional community members. And normally a whole nother round of grand jury subpoenas will result as, you know, as a result of someone giving some type of information.
So I understand that if someone chooses to plead the fifth, that the next step is generally that they're taken before a judge who grants them immunity, and then they have no grounds for pleading the fifth any longer. And if they don't testify, then they are just held in contempt, and that's when people can be locked up. How often did that happen out west?
Well, the process is, you know, you get your subpoena and you show up on the day that's on the subpoena. And you walk into the grand jury room, and the U.S. attorney asks you questions. And then you state that you know, if this is your choice, you state that you are asserting your Fifth Amendment right, and you refuse to answer any questions. At that time, the U.S. attorney has to go up to their boss, the head honcho in the U.S. attorney's office. That person is who authorizes a grant of immunity. That grant of immunity is what makes it so that you no longer have a Fifth Amendment right. Basically, what the immunity says is, we will not prosecute you for any crimes that you admit that you participated in. And so, basically, normally what happens is, on that first day, you show up and you say, I'm not going to answer questions. And then you leave, and they give you another date. Often, they have to go and serve you again with that second date. When you show up the second time, that's where they hand you the piece of paper and say, aha, now you are immunized. You don't have a Fifth Amendment right. And they walk you into the grand jury room, and they ask you questions again. If you continue to assert your Fifth Amendment right or your right to refuse to answer the questions, at that time, you are walked in front of a judge. And the U.S. attorney says, wah, we gave them immunity, and they're still refusing to answer these questions. Judge, order them to do it. And so then the judge will wag his finger and say, you have been ordered to answer these questions. And then everybody walks back across the hall into the grand jury room, and the feds ask you questions again. If you continue to refuse to answer them after the court has ordered you to answer them, then you are marched back in front of the judge, and the U.S. attorney says, you know, you've given him an order to answer. He's still refusing to answer. We want a contempt hearing. The contempt hearing basically is to establish that you were given a lawful order and you refused the order of the court. Normally, that's a separately scheduled court appearance. It's sort of like a mini trial. Your lawyer gets to get up and make a bunch of arguments about all your constitutional rights and why this grand jury is not legal and, you know, is a witch hunt and all of these other things. And at the conclusion of the hearing, the court will either find you in contempt or not. If you're found in contempt, you will be jailed. It's called civil contempt, which basically means that you hold the keys to your jail cell. Literally, at any time, you could purge the contempt by agreeing to answer questions. In the activist realm, the longest that anyone has been held in custody for refusing to answer questions put to them by a grand jury is 6 months, but technically you could be jailed for the duration of the grand jury term. And normally that is 18 months, but they can extend it for another term, though that's fairly rare. And like I said, the longest of any activist that's been held in custody thus far has been 6 months. As soon as the person is put in custody, though, their lawyer will begin the process of filing what are called grumbles motions. And a grumbles motion basically says, Judge, the purpose of putting this person in jail for civil contempt was to coerce them into changing their mind and answering the questions. Well, my client will never change their mind. They are so ethically principled in not participating with this grand jury that you could keep them in jail for 10 years and they're not going to answer any questions. And here's some things they've written about how much they hate grand juries, and here's all these witnesses that will tell you that they are deeply principled in their refusal to participate in a grand jury. And so the coercive purpose of this grand jury incarceration no longer serves any purpose and is now punitive. It's now punishment. And so you have to let them out of custody. And in the rare circumstance where the judge will go with this argument, if it is found to be punitive and not coercive, then they must release you from custody immediately. In most circumstances, the judges will tell you to go sit in your jail cell some more, and then your lawyer appeals it to the Court of Appeals, and usually, you know, things will begin to shift in terms of the dynamics of the grand jury process, and often people are released for one reason or the other during that time period where you're litigating these grumbles motions.
And where are people held? Are they sent to a federal prison, or are they held in their communities?
Normally they are held in their community, you know, in their county jail, because, of course, from the government's perspective, at any time you're going to come to your senses and get back in that grand jury seat and answer questions. So they want to keep you close. If there are rare circumstances where they might transfer you to a federal facility if you're going to be in there for a while, but in almost all circumstances that I'm aware of, the person is held in the county jail where the grand jury is occurring. Because, of course, you know, in most circumstances, we're talking about community members being subpoenaed to a local grand jury, but it's certainly possible, you know, that somebody from Portland could be subpoenaed to a grand jury in Maine, and the feds have to fly them and put them in a hotel.
Meaning Portland, Oregon, right?
Yeah.
We have a Portland
here. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I just mean, you know, they can be, you can be subpoenaed from one state to the other, and the feds have to pay your travel costs, but they won't pay you for your time off of work or any of these other things. But they do have to pay to actually get your body to the site where the grand jury is. And in those circumstances, it's the local communities that need to do support for someone that they may never have even met.
Now, the people that you are aware of who decided to take the time in jail rather than cooperate with the process, what were their grounds beyond self-incrimination? What were their ethical grounds that they were stating for taking that stance?
Well, there's lots of First Amendment grounds, you know, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech. There's also, you know, Sixth Amendment grounds and Fourth Amendment grounds, you know, your right to an attorney to be present. There's a multitude of constitutional bases that have been used time and time again in attempting to defend activists from grand jury persecutions. You know, and one other point I should make, often, well, I won't say often, but there are circumstances where once a person has indicated their refusal to a grand jury, the government simply lets them go. There are a number of reasons why this happens sometimes. Sometimes it's because the person that they've subpoenaed is actually a target. They want to make that person a defendant, and so they don't want to give them immunity because they hope to persecute that person. And so if the person is a dumbass and doesn't get a lawyer and just shows up, you know, and doesn't assert their right to, you know, the Fifth Amendment and just starts answering questions, they are literally incriminating themselves, and the feds are happy to take any information that they want to provide. But sometimes in those circumstances, the person shows up and says, I don't want to answer questions, and the feds say, okay, thanks, goodbye. In other circumstances, the person is such a minor character or is so sympathetic potentially to the media that they decide that they will put their energies in going after somebody else and they will let that person loose. And in other circumstances, there may be lawful bases for a lawyer to file what's called a motion to quash, which basically means a motion to crush the subpoena, to do away with it. If the subpoena, is invalid on its face, or if there are legal arguments that the grand jury is improper, your lawyer can make those before you ever even show up at the grand jury room. And there are circumstances where grand jury subpoenas have been dismissed as a result of those types of motions.
Of the folks who did go the full route and said, no, I'm not going to testify, go ahead and throw me in jail, and ended up spending the term of time in jail, are you in contact with any of them? Do you know if they have regrets or if they would do it again?
I've represented lots and lots of them, and I believe that the vast majority of them would say that they would do it again, because the reason they were willing to go to jail in the first place is because of deeply held beliefs and strong solidarity with their political movements. And political movements throughout our history have had a very strong track record of attempting to resist this type of government encroachment on protected activities. And so I think the vast majority of people that I've represented and I've known that have gone to jail would do it again. And I think the vast majority of them would also say that they were impressed and satisfied with the support that they got from their community. I think of the case of Jeff Hoag, who was a nursing student here in Eugene and who had dated at one time a woman who ended up being one of the defendants in the case. And he went to jail for almost 6 months. And during that time, people helped his partner pay her mortgage and the bills. There were several work parties where people showed up and mowed the lawn and built greenhouses for her, and just the community making sure that while he was in jail, life could move forward as normally as possible on the outside. And, he attempted to continue with school from his jail cell and, did some media and did some writing. And, I think overall, nobody wants to be in jail. And certainly, 6 months is nothing to sneeze at. That is a real interruption in somebody's life, especially, if you're a nursing student or, you've got things going on. But if you are part of a movement and you consider yourself to be an activist, at least this is what he has, said in the past, then, you have taken on the responsibilities of being part of that movement. And with all resistance movements, resisting federal grand juries and federal government spying is part of that obligation for a lot of folks, and they feel ethically principled in conducting themselves that way.
Well, it sounds like a piece of your advice is don't be intimidated. What other advice, as it looks like Maine may be heading in this direction, getting ready to experience some of this, what other words of advice would you have?
Well, I think it's really, knowledge is power, and so it's really important for activist communities to get all the information they can about the grand jury process and, have workshops or have public presentations about the grand jury process. There's lots of great lawyers in your communities that could easily, host a public forum and educate people about the ins and outs and ropes of the federal grand jury process. The other part is, it's time to tighten up the ship. It's time to make sure that support networks are in place, that media is in place, that jail solidarity is in place. Lawyers are put on notice that they might be asked to step in and do some pro bono consulting or representation. It's just important to make sure that your community is prepared for this type of, potential onslaught. And, especially, I guess the other really important part of this piece is it's extremely important for the community not to speculate about what the investigation might be about or who might be a target or who might be involved, because one of the consequences of a grand jury investigation like this is the feds will hit the hive and listen for the buzz. They will do a raid or launch some subpoenas, and then they put their ears to the ground to listen to the rumor mill. And gossip really can kill. people need to really know and understand and practice good security culture. You know, just sitting in a bar and speculating about, oh, you know, what do you think it's about, and who do you think is involved, and, oh, did you hear so-and-so got subpoenaed? I wonder if they're going to go to prison now, or, you know, all of those types of things are really inappropriate when government persecution is occurring in your community. And a lot of people talk the talk about security culture, but very few actually practice it, you know, whether it's over email, phone calls, meetings, or in person. You know, don't give the government information that they don't already have if that is your intention.
But at the same time, you're not recommending that people remain isolated. If they have received a subpoena, you're not suggesting that they not tell anybody about it. That's the point when they should reach out and let their community know what's going on?
Well, I think that's true. You know, obviously, it's a personal choice. You know, we're not all bound to lockstep with each other. You know, obviously, we retain our individual will. But definitely, you know, from our perspective, the advice is, you know, to be very vocal and public about what's going on. Shedding light in a dark corner can sometimes cause the roaches to crawl back into the cracks, so to speak. If the feds think that people are intimidated and afraid, they gain power from that. If a person who gets a grand jury subpoena tells their community they've received the subpoena, hopefully the community will respond by asking them, you know, what do you need by way of support? Can we help you get an attorney? What information do you, you know, need to try to quell some of your concerns about, you know, the undertakings you're about to have thrust upon you? And, you know, obviously understanding the breadth and scope of people who have been targeted by grand jury subpoenas may help the lawyers representing those people to understand what is the government's true intentions with these, you know, subpoenas or with this investigation. All of those little bits of information can help them in crafting motions to quash or motions to defend the people from the grand jury process. You know, I think the most important part when someone gets a subpoena is to make sure that the community is activated in a support mechanism. You know, it's not the community's job to try to figure out why did this person get a subpoena or is this person in big trouble. You know, that's not the job of the community. The job of the community, in my opinion, is to have solidarity with these people and make sure that they have as much support as needed for them to make their difficult choice. You know, if someone thinks that they have abundant support, they may feel more at ease in potentially going to jail. If they are isolated and have no community support, their choice becomes much tougher. And we want people to have the freedom, the luxurious freedom, to make their own true choices based on their own personal ethics, not based on coercion or fear or, you know, dire need for financial assistance. You know, the CLDC has a lot of information that we can share with communities. You know, if there is a community group that, you know, wants more information, they can look on our website, which is cldc.org, or they can get in touch with us. We also are more than happy to assist lawyers who might take on some of these cases in providing them with briefs and, you know, other legal information that can make their jobs a little easier as well.
All right. Well, thank you for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Lauren Regan. She's an attorney and the executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center located in Eugene, Oregon. That's all we have time for today, but be sure to catch Weekend Voices on Saturday morning at 10 when local attorneys Lynn Williams and Phil Warden weigh in on this issue. You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. Our programs are archived at weru.org, and you can contact us by emailing news@weru.org. With Meredith DeFrancesco, I'm Amy Brown. Thanks for listening.